Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is the Win Tracy recording at 12:36 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is October 27th. Today being Friday, of course, this is the big picture, long-term video and audio for the various different asset classes. And this was a pretty big day in stock markets, and it's probably worth just going over what was happening this week. The S&P 500 has broken out to a new all-time high, and this is extending what has been a really impressive 6-week advance. And obviously you can see on the chart that there is this somewhat overbought condition relative to the trend mean, but it's not the largest overextension that we've seen within the context of this decade-long trend. But what we can certainly say is that it's important to think about how a trend evolves over time, because if we think about the psychological perception stages of major bull and bear markets, those are points that we cover in quite a lot of detail at the chart seminar. And then another point that we talk about is the fractal nature of markets, so that we see exactly the same types of patterns in very short term, even minute by minute trading, that we do in very long-term charts. Even if we go back not just a year or 2 years or 10 years or decades or centuries, we see the same evolution of these psychological perception stages. So then I think it is important to preface, when we talk about where are we in terms of which psychological perception stage are we in, it's important to think about in what term of the fractal nature of markets are we talking about. Is it in the very long term, or in the medium term, or the short term? The way that we consider long term is in secular trends, trends that can last for decades. For the short term, we generally tend to think of things in anything from a few days to a few weeks or months, and a medium term is from anything from a few months to a few years. But at this trend that we've had in the S&P 500 since, and indeed many stock markets since 2009, is a medium-term trend within the context of a long-term trend. When we look at the longer-term chart and think about this not just in terms of the last decade or the aftermath of the credit crisis, but within the context of the long term, that the most important thing that happened was the very long term range that we saw between 1999 and 2013, and then this incredibly emphatic breakout, where the price has gone from a low, and that was a failed downside break in the context of that range, down to 666 in 2009. It's currently at 2500. So the index has gone up almost four times in the last 8 years, which is really quite an incredible advance. Now, that is in the context of a new secular bull market, that the S&P 500 has had these periods where it has gone sideways for very lengthy periods of time, upwards of anything from 10 to 20 years, and then those ranges are resolved by emphatic breakouts. And we have three instances of that in the last 100 years. The range that followed the aftermath of the 1929 crash persisted for 25 years. The range that we had from the peak, and I think if we really are rational about it, that the real peak was in about 1965, and then the market broke out in 1981, so 16 years. And then the pause that we had from 2000 was about 13 years. If anything, we can say that these periods of secular stagnation have tended to be shorter over the context of the last 100 years, whereas when they are resolved on the upside, we get these generational long bull markets. And if the market broke out in 2013 to new highs, that would be mark the historical date of the beginning of the secular bull market. And if history is any guide, then we could see prices rallying for the next 20 years. So that would take us out to 2033. And that's just a rough ballpark measure. Then that's the big picture. That's the long term. That means then that in the context of the medium term, we should always keep that in the back of our minds, that there is no long-term bull market isn't going to be punctuated eventually by occasional pullbacks. And we saw a fairly significant pullback between 2012 or it was really, sorry, between the end of 2014 and the beginning of 2016. There were evolving type 2 top characteristics in that range. And if the breakdown in early 2016 had been sustained, it would have been a top, but it wasn't. It was the first big consolidation after a major breakout and a first step above the base, and now we have had this very persistent advance. There is no denying that this period of very low volatility that we've had since November of last year has been much more consistent than even this very consistent period of trading between about 2012 and 2014, where the market went up in a very orderly manner, found support in the region of the trend mean on repeated instances, and then began to lose momentum with a reaction that was a loss of consistency at the penultimate high back in late 2014. On this occasion, we have had much shallower pullbacks all the way through this year, and now the pace of the advance is picking up. Now, let's then go back and think about where are we in terms of the psychological perception stages just within the context of this medium-term advance. Well, certainly back in 2009, we were in disbelief. Nobody believed that this was going to happen. If anyone had gone on CNBC or and of course, it's impossible because there's nobody would have been given the time of day to talk about that kind of bullish scenario back in 2009. So the crowd was completely disappointed, and not just disappointed, but aggressively against the idea that the market could ever go up again. Most people were talking about the next leg down back in 2009. So that was the era of disbelief. Then in 2013 and 2014, we started moving into acceptance that quantitative easing was something that could really get people's could get asset prices moving again. We had QE1, we had QE2, we had QE3, and people were looking at the pace with which the Fed was printing money, and now we are in a period of time where people are looking at the impact that tax cuts could have on the US corporate environment. And that is a somewhat different environment than relying on liquidity, because if they cut taxes, then that is going to contribute to positive earnings or a bump to earnings that are not temporary, but that could persist for the lengthy medium term. So that is also contributing to the consistency of this advance. What we all know is that bull markets thrive on liquidity, and we have had ample liquidity thrown at the market from not just the Federal Reserve but central banks all over the world. And now we're seeing that we're getting pro-cyclical, I think pro-cyclical fiscal and monetary policy at a period of time where we're already years into an expansion. And if history again is any guide, when we get these pro-cyclical policies where deficits are expanded into an already mature expansion, then you get asset price inflation taking off again. And that is also usually when you start to see inflation, because those types of policies are directly inflationary. If you are handing a tax cut to people and volunteering to have a 1.5 trillion deficit, then this is going to create inflation. And that is what the stock market is reflecting. So on the weekly chart, we can see that the price is beginning to accelerate. And that would take us from a period of acceptance into a period of euphoria. I think, you know, we have seen more than enough of people saying that the cyclically adjusted PE is at historically high levels. But the time to worry about the cyclically adjusted PE being at high levels is when it turns around, and that there is no logical limit to how high it can go based on the enthusiasm of crowds. What we can see on the daily chart of the S&P 500 is that the pace of the advance has picked up. And if it were to remain consistent, then it should have a consolidation. And we had a little bit of a pullback the last week or so, but certainly nothing to shake the complacency of the bulls. And now the index is at a new high. The NASDAQ 100 is breaking successfully above the 6,000 level. It has been ranging mostly below it since June, broke above it in early October, and then is reasserting on the upside in here. It is being led higher by some of its largest constituents. Amazon today rallying pretty emphatically from the region of the trend mean and topping the 1100 level. So a new all-time high, and resolving this almost six-month range with a clear upward break. And Google is in a very similar story, that it has been ranging around this $1,000 area for the last 6 months and then broke successfully above it in here today. Microsoft is, I think, arguably now beginning to accelerate higher. It had already been doing rather well, and then we have now had this blowout in terms of its earnings in here today, and it is now really quite overextended. This is a very bullish period for these types of shares, and they are doing phenomenally well. Nonetheless, when we see that these overextensions relative to the trend mean, like this accelerating market on Amazon, what that generally tells us is that the risk is increasing, that people are getting to a point where they are no longer thinking about the potential for a pullback. And how is this? But of course, the way to think about it is slightly different in every bull market, and the way that it is being manifested in this bull market is in the growth of ETFs and the growth of risk parity and algorithmic trading systems, because they are earnings agnostic. What they are looking at is flow, and what that is more, it's I think it's a modern equivalent of what we saw in the 1990s, that earnings don't matter. Because when we look at, for example, the NASDAQ 100 and look at the weightings inside it, and it doesn't give us them, but we know what the big weightings are. They are Apple, Amazon, and all of the FAMGs. So what we're getting is, when people buy an ETF, what they're mostly buying are those big shares, and then the weighting of the index is based upon, or the ETF is weighted on the index. People just buy them all. The fact that the Russell 2000, that of the 2000 shares is probably 500, don't make any money at all, really is completely irrelevant to people that are buying the ETF. They're just buying all the shares. And what that is contributing to is this flow of money into these very large companies, that there is a very clear benefit to having a large market cap. And that is that means that these large companies are accruing greater and greater flows. So what that, if you're getting investors that are investing on a basis of being earnings agnostic, then that's a clear sign that we are getting into the third psychological perception stage, which is characterized in the end by euphoria. And it is often associated with acceleration. So this is not the time to be overly pessimistic. And I opened a short in the Dow Jones earlier this week, which is not looking particularly smart. I really should have held on to my Nikkei long. And I think that And my theory for almost the last year has been that a return to outperformance by Japan is perhaps the greatest confirmation that we're back in an inflationary cycle. That I think that it is arguable, and that we should at least have the discussion that Japan tried to foment inflation following the crash in the early 1990s, and that I think incredibly debilitating bear market all the way through the 90s and into the early 2000s. And they tried to foment inflation and failed, and they failed on repeated occasions. So then we have to ask, was it that was their failure part of our I think the best way to think about it is, could they have succeeded? Was it that their policies were wrong, or were they just in a macro environment where they were really attempting to do something that was next to near impossible, because we were in one of the greatest disinflationary periods in history? And what we are now getting is a change. That if we are in a period of time where the US economy, which is still the largest, is going for pro-cyclical policies, where it is expanding deficits in a period where we have the participation rate is ticking up, the wage growth is appreciating, unemployment is deteriorating, and the economy is firing on all cylinders, and now we're going to get a tax cut on top of that. Well, then that's going to supercharge the growth in the short term, and then there's likely to be a significant hangover. But between now and then, there is ample potential for additional upside. And what we saw this week is not just that the Nikkei was in robust form, but that the yield on the 10-year in the US was able to move above 2.4%. Now, it was a bit weaker in here today, but this is a very important market because it has now broken that progression of lower rally highs. We may yet get some consolidation, but when this eventually sustains a move above 2.5%, then it will be trading in the upper side of its base formation. This base formation has been underway, I think, really since 2011. So we've had this base formation for 6 years already. Now, type 3 base formations can last substantially longer than that. It might continue ranging for quite a bit longer. But if central banks are beginning to raise interest rates, and we'll find out next week if the Bank of England is willing to raise interest rates, if they're reducing the quantity of money that they have been pumping into the system, then that is going to represent a headwind eventually. But I think the most important point to remember is that it's only the Fed is removing liquidity from the market today, and only presently at 10 billion a month. The ECB is going to reduce its purchases from 60 to 30 billion beginning at the beginning in January. So they're still buying 60 billion euros a year. And I thought this was a rather interesting graphic. So let me just pull it over and we'll see it. It gives us the monetary policy and the fiscal policy of a significant number of countries. And if we look right in the middle, where you have neutral fiscal policy and neutral monetary policy, you have Switzerland and the UK and India. So India has moved from tightening to neutral, and that is one of the contributing factors in the performance of the stock market. It's also been one of the factors in the recent pause in the rupee's appreciation. Then we can also see that Indonesia has moved from, it's still in neutral fiscal policy, but it has moved from being a loosening to a neutral phenomenon in terms of the monetary policy. But if we look up here, then the US is moving from tightening to neutral. what that suggests is that the market believes that the Fed is going to be very slow in raising interest rates. And that, I think, is quite interesting, whereas Japan is both fiscally loose and monetary policy loose, and that is contributing to the outperformance in nominal terms of the stock market. And I think this is a very useful graphic to bear in mind. So, for example, we've also seen that Mexico and Argentina are no longer tightening, that Saudi Arabia has to tighten because it has this headwind of the oil price. But when we look at the oil price, it was able to sustain a move above $60 in here today. And this is a pretty impressive breakout. Saudi Arabia needs a higher oil price, and they've been forced into both fiscal and monetary tightening in order to balance the books, or even come close to balancing the books. And most importantly, they really do want to IPO Saudi Aramco. That says more about their long-term conclusions about the viability of their business than any other factor anywhere. And they have a vested interest in getting the highest price possible. And of course, the other point, and it's something that a point David has made on successive occasions at the chart seminar over the years, was that when is the best time to sell your company is usually when you can get more for it than you think it's worth. We see ample evidence of that in the ICO markets and cryptocurrencies right now. And this is an interesting environment because we're in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and generally speaking, that is good for the energy market. And oil prices are rallying at right now. And part of the reason for that is because there is continued enthusiasm that Saudi Arabia will continue to limit supply. And what I found interesting, and it is still really quite tentative, Southwest Energy, which has been in the which can only be described as the doldrums for much of the year, had an upside key reversal yesterday, an upside follow-through in here today. But when we look at that on the weekly chart, you can barely see it because the decline has been so precipitous since that peak back in 2014. And of course, Southwestern is almost primarily, or almost exclusively, I should say, tied to unconventional supply. So with prices above $60 again, well, then that is exactly when these types of companies should start drilling once more. So we then know that there's a lot of supply is going to come to bear, but it takes time to get that supply to market. It might be a few months, and in that interval, there is the potential for oil prices to rally. Now, when we think about where are we in terms of this cycle, if we are moving into the third psychological perception stage of the medium-term bull market, that bull market that started in 2009 and has persisted since, that is really only the very early stages of the secular bull market, and that it is going to be punctuated by a recession eventually. When is that recession likely? Well, there's no evidence of it just yet. And the types of things that I'm looking at are, and I'll go through them one by one, so that we can, and I think that this is a worthwhile exercise that we should do at least once a week. And this is high yield spreads. They're not quite as low as they have been on record, but they're not far off it either. And most particularly, they are trending lower. As long as that is trending lower as opposed to trending higher, then it's unlikely that we're getting a tightness of credit. If, and of course, the high yield sector is particularly sensitive to investment flows and interest rates, because when they come to refi, and a point that Jeff Gundlach made at a talk I went to see a couple of years ago was that high yield debt is very rarely paid off. Generally speaking, it's either that the company gets taken over or they refinance it. So they are sensitive to investment flows and interest rates because they're always looking to refinance their debt. And if they can't do that, then it's going to become really quite obvious in the in the spreads quite quickly. And then if we look at the yield curve, the spread between the 10-year and the 2-year, and it has been a reliable lead indicator for recessions for the last few decades in the USA, but it is nowhere near zero. And even if it were at zero, then we would have a lead indicator for the next recession for anything out from 6 to 18 months. So that is also not flashing red. Then we also know that unemployment is pretty close to record lows. So that's also something else that would be an indication of a future recession. But there's no evidence of it just yet. And then there is the additional point about oil. If oil were surging higher, then it becomes a headwind to economic growth, and it can be the harbinger of a future recession. Well, oil prices have just broken above 60. They're not at $100 or 120, and therefore it is nothing to worry about at the present moment. Then there is the additional point about inflation, which is well under control in the majority of countries. And then we also have the point about interest rates. Well, interest rates are only just beginning to rise in the US and just about nowhere else in terms of the major markets. That despite all of the talk that China has had about the tightening that they've introduced, if we go back and look at that chart, we can see that China is not tightening. There it is, right in this neutral to loosening. So it's got neutral monetary policy and loose fiscal policy. So it would be very hard to say that China is tightening. What we could probably more correctly say is that China is tailoring its monetary policy and fiscal policy to complete its political objectives. And the A-share index continues to trend higher, albeit in a pretty modest form. Whereas when we look at the H-share index in Hong Kong, it's within the context of a almost decade-long range, but it is marching higher in a very consistent manner. I think one of the other big markets that has been inflated beyond recognition is property because of low interest rates. And therefore, we should also keep an eye on markets like Hong Kong or Sydney or indeed San Francisco or Vancouver or London, and how do properties do there? And because they'll also be sensitive to investment flows internationally as well as interest rates. But again, these are things to watch, and so far, there's none of them are breaking. There's none of them are really an indication that we are in the latter stages of this bull market, but rather that we are only beginning to enter the third psychological perception stage, that the acceleration, if it occurs, is ahead of us, not behind us, and therefore the best position to be in is to be long. That is despite the fact that valuations are no longer at cheap levels, and that the likelihood is that they are going to appreciate or they are going to rise more. Now, when we look at US corporate profits, then this is another point that is, I think, going to be parsed by fundamental analysts. This has been updated since June. It won't be updated right until the end of this month, I believe. And that's also because we haven't yet had the conclusion of third quarter earnings. But one of the more important points is that it has tended to peak before major market peaks. We certainly saw that back in 1997, and we saw it again in 2006. Well, it hit an important peak in 2014, and that is part of the reason why valuations have appreciated, because corporate profits have been going sideways, but the price has gone up a lot since then. But if we are looking at the results from all the corporate earnings that we've had, and the what we've also seen over much of the last 3 or 4 months has been that earnings revisions have been on the upside rather than disappointing, then there is the potential that this corporate profits chart could break on the upside the next time that it is updated. And that is something that could then contribute even further to the euphoria that is growing in the market. And it would also help to reinforce the I think the conclusion that many people have that the best way to invest is via ETFs. It would reinforce the value element of risk parity trades, and it would further contribute to the complacency of the market. And all of these rationales would just I think be would confirm that we're moving into the third psychological perception stage. So we know what to look for. None of those factors are a problem right now. In the absence of them being a problem, then the natural position to have is to be long. Now, when we think about that in terms of what's happening on Wall Street, then we have the Wall Street leash effect. And Wall Street is fine. And if people are looking at Wall Street, they're either going to be invested in technology or they are going to be looking for additional yield somewhere else. And certainly, we have seen a significant number of markets breaking on the upside. And the most recent of those this week was India. India has been, the Nifty has been consolidating in the region of 10,000 for the last 3 months and then broke above it in here this week. That was on the back of bank recapitalizations. And State Bank of India is one of the state-owned banks that has benefited from this recapitalization. So it surged higher intra-week and got all the way up to test its peak from 2010. Now it's probably due some consolidation, but this is a sea change for the banking sector. And considering the ambitions that India has, the enormous number of young people that it needs to find jobs for, that it needs to be able to deliver a better standard of living for hundreds of millions of people if it is to have any chance of sustaining social cohesion, then it absolutely needs to have a banking sector that is fit for purpose. And this $32 billion recapitalization of the state-owned banking sector, and finally the aggressive handling of the non-performing loans issue that has been something that has been wearing on an investor interest for much of the last 5 years. This is a really quite profound change, and it is likely to help to drive interest in the Indian market because it is a further evidence that governance is improving. And that was something that nobody wanted to believe just 3 or 4 years ago. That if you remember back in the Commonwealth Games, that nobody or that all the news stories that were coming back was that the stadiums were in a shambles. And that was on the back of these very public rape cases and the victimization of women in society. And then the rupee was accelerating lower as well. So sentiment towards India was about as bearish as one could possibly imagine. And the fact that you had a majority and that you now have single-party government, that you have a reform-minded administration, that are in fact delivering upon reform, that is almost beyond recognition compared to the squabbling and disagreement that you had in the last administration. So this is a clear indication that democracy can work, that usually it takes a crisis to get people to coalesce around and support ideas that are in many respects can be described as delayed gratification. We're certainly seeing that in India, and we're starting to see the benefits from it, and it represents a significant bullish long-term growth story for one simple reason, that you have the confluence of technological innovation, a very young population, improving governance, and unchallenging energy prices. And for a country like India, which is an energy importer, these are very important considerations. And they're all coalescing to drive this bull market. And as long as governance continues to improve, then the likelihood is that India will continue to appreciate. And I think that that is a very important topic, that when we think about the long-term potential of emerging markets, obviously the Wall Street leash effect and what's happening in the wider world is going to be important, but by far the most important long-term characteristic is going to be whether governance is improving. That is going to be the real difference in how well some of these countries deal with the crises that occasionally pop up. If you've got improving governance, then they can rally and rally around the central idea of what needs to be accomplished, or they can give way to deteriorating governance, employ the wrong strategies, and then economic growth is lost for decades. So I think India still remains a very, very, I think, interesting case, and it's certainly one that when we think about governance improving and the way that we define that is an independent judiciary, that you have property rights and minority shareholder interests, then you can tick all those boxes for India. It's not quite possible to do that for China. You do not have an independent judiciary. Property rights are rather fickle, and minority shareholder interests don't really exist. Certainly, China is an emerging superpower, but from an investment perspective, then it is quite different from India, and I think that dichotomy is probably something that is going to be increasingly realized by long-term globally oriented investors. I think Indonesia falls somewhere in between. Governance is improving, but it also has considerable work to do in terms of the pace of that reform. But nonetheless, this market is breaking on the upside. The Thai market has come through the death of the king last June without falling apart, and the index is breaking up out of this almost 5-year range. The Philippines, which mostly makes headlines for the ferocity of the war on drugs, has also broken on the upside, and it does look like we're going to get some consolidation, but these are markets that are breaking up and out of long-term ranges. Well, what did we see in Europe this week? But it was that the ECB is now going to be tapering their quantitative easing, and Mario Draghi talked down the euro, so the stock market broke out to new highs. It was in additional ups in positive territory in here today, and Europe is playing catch up. And Europe today is where the US was a few years ago. It hasn't quite yet got back up towards the upper side of this range, but I think the odds are that it is going to get back up towards 450 and probably following some consolidation breakout. The Europe Stoxx 600, which includes the UK, Switzerland, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, is coming back up towards this 400 level, and that represents the upper side of a 17-year range. Europe has been plagued by divisiveness, and not least because of the sovereign debt crisis, which was not really a sovereign debt crisis, but rather, if we think about why was it called the sovereign debt crisis, it was because all these public sector debts were foisted upon the governments of the periphery, and that created a sovereign debt crisis, whereas what it was in fact was a banking crisis that became a national crisis rather than allowing those banks to go bust. So that has allowed, or I think has resulted in Europe lagging the outperformance of just about everywhere else. But it is looking increasingly likely that the Euro Stoxx is going to break upwards. and the FTSE 100, which went sideways for 17 years, broke upwards and is now back testing its highs. Now, these are all benefiting from synchronized global economic expansion, the fact that we have had easy monetary policy for a prolonged period of time, and in many respects still have it, and that this is contributing to asset price inflation. One of the problems that all of this has created, and perhaps it is also one of the reasons that we have such enormous support for the pro-cyclical policies that are being introduced, is that because of asset price inflation, that we are now getting this massive gap between the haves and the have-nots. And unfortunately, there are a lot more of the have-nots than the haves, and that is contributing to a rise of populism, or what I would prefer to call it is a rise of reactionism to the status quo. We're already seeing the evolution of that in Europe, with Catalonia, with Hungary, with the Czech Republic and Poland, all electing reactionary-type governments. The same thing in Austria. There are significant reactionary movements in Spain, in Italy, in the Netherlands, and these are all important factors in terms of the ECB's policy. But I thought this was a very interesting graphic I found today, and it shows that in the UK we have a very wide gap between the haves and the have-nots, and that is a symptom of why you had such support for Brexit, that people want to take back control. And of course, that desire for control is going to be manifested in different places, in different ways. So rather than think about it as a specific issue relating to one country, I think it is more illustrative to look at it as a trend of people looking to take back control, whether that is the case for Scotland or the UK or Catalonia or Spain or Italy, then it's a common thread throughout. It's exactly the same thing that we're seeing in the USA, which is why we're getting such support for alternative strategies. And I think that this is also going to contribute to asset price inflation, that when people vote for more money in their pockets, when they vote for deficits and for tax cuts, what they are mostly voting for is more money in their pockets. And that is directly inflationary. It eventually will cause a problem, but probably not for a couple of years, because it takes time for these kinds of moves to filter down into the economy. Then when the deficits need to be repaid, we get a crisis, we get a recession, and then we're going to have some problems. But there isn't a great deal of evidence that that those problems are going to arise imminently. And in the meantime, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Now, if I've spent the majority of this broadcast talking about the medium term, we should consider what the long term is, because the pace of technological innovation is only accelerating. The risk that companies like Amazon have is from antitrust, because they sell everything and they're acting as the disruptor for just about all industries relating to the consumer. So that is a trend that is going to play out not just in the US, but in a number of just about all countries. And then we have the pace of technological innovation in energy, that battery technology is not quite on a par yet with what can be achieved from the internal combustion engine. But it's getting rapidly closer to good enough, and that is going to contribute to an energy revolution where we really get abundant energy, and the pace of innovation in the renewable sector is also picking up. So if we have both storage and renewable energy, what that is going to contribute to is energy independence or close or an approximation of independence for an increasingly large number of countries, which on its own is a motivation for pursuing that ambition. One of the reasons that so many countries run deficits is because they are exporting billions every year for importing energy. So if they can at least stop that leaching away of revenues, then they have the potential to do better internally. Well, these are all long-term themes. And what we're starting to see in technology is that it is certainly being appreciated, and that this is helping to drive the bull market, most particularly in terms of the control of data. Because if we solve the energy problem, then the real valuable asset is going to be data. And both access to data, curatorship of the data, and sales of data. And what individuals are going to receive in return for that data is going to be progressively more impressive. The fact that Google, Amazon, and Apple are all selling home speakers that are conduits for their personal assistants is something that I think is the thin end of the wedge, that we are going to have much more of that, and that all electronics will have some form of AI embedded in them within the next 3 or 4 years, not to mind over the next decade. In the healthcare sector, CRISPR has been a catalyst for innovation that is going to deliver within the next 5 or 10 years customized medicine. And we're already seeing the first evidence of that in immuno-oncology. These are incredibly powerful, not just short-term, but long-term themes that if we have more people living longer and more healthful lives, then that is an additional source of growth, because if they're living longer and more healthy, they're cheaper to look after. So that is also likely to help to drive economic growth. And that, I think, runs at odds with the perception of what it is going to cost to look after a lot of old people. That looking after a lot of old people becomes a problem when it becomes expensive. If we can ensure that people live longer, healthier lives, and that then means that they are productive, and that also helps to fuel economic growth. These are long-term themes, but and I think they're going to flow out independently of what happens in terms of markets. But we know that markets are discounting mechanisms, that these themes will be discounted by the market, and that if we are indeed moving into the third psychological perception stage, then a lot of very bullish stories are going to get front-loaded. And that means that we will have to monitor the evolution of these stories over time. But I think in the meantime, the most important thing is that we have had some very impressive moves, that some markets are accelerating or simply beginning to accelerate, that clear downward dynamics will be required to check these advances, and that if we do see clear downward dynamics, well, then we will have the next reversion back to the mean. The fact that volatility measures have been so incredibly low is a testament to the fact that we have had a phenomenally inert environment where the growth of ETFs and the and risk parity strategies and quantitative strategies and people selling time have contributed to this environment. They are uniquely sensitive to rising interest rates. But this low volatility is an enabler. It's an enabler for the persistence of the bull market. When it changes, then we will have confirmation that one of the major animating factors behind this advance is also changing. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.